Hello, and welcome to the Beautifully Rare Podcast. My name is Sam Bish, along with my co-host, Bryn Bish. We're going to be talking today a little bit about Bryn's background. She's going to give us some details about her life with a progressive neurological disease, her time in academia, also being Killian's mom and what that's like. So without further ado, let's go ahead and roll into it. You know, Bryn, how's your Saturday going?
Saturday's going pretty well. You know, I went out to breakfast with my sister-in-law.
Brought back some amazing French toast.
Yeah, it was pretty good. It was this new breakfast shop, and it was cool. I felt, you know, this time last year, I would have thought we would have these kind of experiences. We were still in, I think, an inpatient rehab unit.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were living in that hotel.
Mm-hmm. This was the in-between time because it was right at the beginning of November.
That's right.
That's when we had to kind of...
We were homeless.
We were homeless this time last year.
One year ago,
the Bish family was homeless.
And here we are at the top.
So, Bryn, I want you to tell us a little bit more about SMA. Mm. What it is, how you got your diagnosis, some background of you and SMA.
Mm.
Fill us in.
Yeah, I guess I'll start with my diagnosis story. For those of our listeners who have a young kid with an SMA diagnosis, that process was very different when I was young. Nobody really knew what SMA was. And it's one of the many benefits, I think, of social media is that it's, you know, growing this kind of attention around these very interesting and rare and nuanced lives. And so that's a really good thing. But when I was diagnosed, I was 10 years old, and I'm a twin. I have an older twin brother. And so I was always like a few months behind developmentally, like physical development. Developmental milestones were always like a few months behind. But that could also be like reasoned away from me being a girl and him being a boy. Typically, you know, like that's not out of the norm.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom always saw like soft signs of something being off.
Mm-hmm.
Balance was off. I was always falling behind.
Mm-hmm.
And so she always had these soft signs. And so it was fifth grade. And that was the first year of did you ever do the presidential fitness test?
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it was awful.
It's awful.
Coming from two FFKs,
former fat kids. That's right. FFKs unite. It's pretty terrible for anyone who was unathletic. And it was like you would just be the highlight and target of bullying. It was it was terrible. So this was like the first year that public school did this kind of training this presidential fitness test was in when I was 10 years old. And so I remember doing all of the other flexibility, you know, like you have all those kind of spot exams and then you have the big mile run.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the last things that they do.
Yeah, you stand there sweating.
Yeah.
Just so nervous.
Yeah, it's like,
you know you're coming in last. So.
What kind of a public test is this that you have to like, you line up on a line, they blow the whistle and you have to run a mile and then they track your time.
Yeah.
And so I remember lining up, the whistle blowing, and then everybody just taking off. You know, ahead of me. And, you know, I knew I was never a big runner, but it was like the first time where I was like saliently compared to my peers. And so I tried running and I was like, well, maybe I just don't know how, maybe I haven't really tried. And so I would run and it would be like 1, 2, 3 strides and then I'd fall. And so I'd get back up, 1, 2, 3 strides and then I'd fall. And so I ended up just walking the rest of it until, you know, towards the end, the last fourth of the class was kind of like, you know, trickling in, and it was me and one other girl. And so I remember the specific moment that a light bulb went off in my mind was the gym teacher was taking down everybody's scores. You know, she was saying, Bryn and this other girl, like, you guys need to hurry up, finish up your time, you know, just gentle encouragement at the time. And so she was busy with the scores, and I remember the athletic boys at the time ended up seeing this as a prime opportunity to make fun of me and this other girl. So I was trying to hustle, and I was running, and they were making fun of me. Now, have you seen those memes, those reels where it's like what I think I look like when I'm running and then what I actually look like?
Yeah, I know exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, like what I think I look like when it's like this beautiful gazelle, you know, in a field, and then what I'm actually looking like, and it's like just a duck in water or something. Or
like a giraffe tripping over their feet. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the moment for me, because how they were mocking my attempt to run was that they were waddling like a duck. And I looked at that and I was like, huh, that, like, they're making fun of me. Like, it's so funny at the time, because at the time I wasn't offended of being, I was more curious as to the fact that they were making fun of me running in this way. So I went home that day and I said to my mom, I was like, I think there's something wrong. Like, I was made fun of, but this is how they were making fun of me. And I was trying really hard. I just felt like I couldn't do it. And it's coming so easily to other people. So at that time, my mom was kind of ready. She was like, yeah, I also think that there's something wrong. And she, you know, I'll talk about how the good things that my mom really helped shape my perception about my disability in good and bad ways. I love her to death. She's my best friend. And, you know, we talk about this all the time, about this was very intuitive of my mom to wait until I was ready, because otherwise you would have just been dragging around a child who didn't understand and didn't have ownership. Because the first appointment I went into, I had ownership. She encouraged me to be vocal about what I was experiencing, which was kind of cool. So we bounced around because nobody knew what SMA was and how it presented. Mm-hmm. And so SMA, well, I'll get into that. So we first went to the pediatrician, who said, yeah, it's something muscular, but like a sports medicine specialist should be able to diagnose like what muscles are weak, and they would just know more about the musculoskeletal system.
Yeah.
So we go there and they say, I don't really know what this is. It could be some sort of dystrophy. So we go to a geneticist, and she was like, I actually don't want to do broad testing until you see a pediatric neurologist. And I mean, within a few minutes of just a clinical presentation, he was like, yeah, I'm like 90% sure you have what's called SMA. I need to do a genetic test in order to make sure. So we took a blood test, and then a week later he gave my mom a call, and then that's when we were confirmed that we had SMA. Yeah. That I was diagnosed with SMA type 3.
Wow. So your mom gets this call. She has this conversation with him on the phone. You know, as a parent who might be receiving a diagnosis like this, or maybe SMA itself, what advice do you give parents that might receive a call like this? Is there anything that comes to your mind that, you know, you could relay?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. You know, my mom and I have a very good relationship, and we always talk about, like, what did we do well about this? You know, what did we do not well? And, you know, I'll talk about my journey of how I accepted this for what it was, but it wasn't immediate. And so I remember we went into another appointment to talk more once we got the confirmation that I had SMA. And he hands me probably what was the only like standard of care document that existed at the time, which was written by him. He actually went into being a pediatric neurologist for the sole purpose of wanting to treat SMA. And so he's like, this was his career.
Yeah, the person to go to.
Yeah, and it was like in my backyard. And so he gave me the only, it was like a very poorly photocopied, I still have it to this day. It was a very poorly,
you kept it.
I kept it, yeah.
Wow.
Very poorly photocopied, you know, 15-page document about everything that you need to know about SMA.
Wow.
And so at 10 years old, I remember just scanning the document, and what I saw was motor neuron loss. Didn't really know what that was. Loss in ability to walk, wheelchair, and progressive weakness. And even at 10 years old, I knew what that was. I knew exactly where I was sitting at the time. It was in our library. And I closed the pamphlet and I shove it as far back as possible. It was kind of like this like representation of this is, I was confused because yesterday I didn't know I had this thing.
Yeah.
And now at 10 years old, I have to figure out how to integrate a lifetime of weakness.
Yeah.
And right before puberty or at the cusp of puberty, it's terrifying. Yeah. You know, you just, when you go through life, you don't question until something big like that pops up in your life. What does this mean? Like, what is this going to hold me back on?
Yeah.
Is it going to prevent me from getting married, going to college, like having a career? Even at that age, I saw these people doing wonderful things, and I never questioned if it was even possible for me to do that. Mm-hmm. And now I had to figure out how I was to do that, and it was incredibly scary and terrifying.
You didn't want
to
think about it.
No, I didn't.
You know, you shoving that pamphlet into the very back of that library shelf is very symbolic of you saying, no,
right.
I'm going to choose to ignore this. If I ignore it, it's not there.
Exactly. Mm. Yes, that was 100% how I perceived it. And so when I was talking to my mom, I was like, at that time, I was like, I don't feel any different. I don't feel any weaker than I did yesterday or the week before or anything like that. I just run differently. Like, that's why I went in, and now I have this crazy diagnosis that somehow I have to think about going in a wheelchair. Like, it just didn't make sense to me.
Yeah. And I'm the same person today that I was on the day of the test. So yeah.
Exactly. And so she's her and you know, her response was, well, Bryn, what does your name mean? And my name means strong in Gaelic. And so she goes, that's how you're going to fight this, you know? And it was this, we're going to fight this. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get weaker, you know, and you can beat this disease. And at the time, even if she may have meant that differently, mm-hmm. there was this kind of like fight mentality. And I really struggled with that because I interpreted that at my age of, this is something I can fight. If I fight this, you know, disability or this disease, I won't let it consume my body.
No.
I won't let it, you know, make me get any weaker.
Yeah. Now, with that in mind and you having that mentality at that time, did you find it helpful? Do you wish you didn't have that mindset? Do you wish it would have been different? What are your thoughts?
I think that this is the advice I would give parents, mm-hmm. is to talk from day one about acceptance. What does life look like with integrating this into your identity?
Yeah.
Not making it your identity, but integrating it. It's kind of like any other piece of your identity. Like, you're a guy. And so that has an impact on how you perceive fatherhood. How you perceive your role as a husband, like, that is a part of your identity in every part of the way. It's no different from disability. And this is very contrary to how many people choose to perceive disability, right?
Yeah.
There's this notion of, like, you need to, you know, I'm not disabled. It doesn't define me. But in reality, and you know this, SMA does define a lot of aspects of my life. It's defining our very breadwinner homemaker model.
It's
defining my limitations on what I can do as a conventional mother, but it's not all defining. Mm-hmm. It's important to recognize that disability has its place, and how you perceive it, I think, is where the power comes in. You can either see that as, I'm disabled, therefore I can't be a mom, or you can say, I'm disabled, it's providing limitations, and yet I can still be a mom in my own way, and this is how it looks like.
Yeah.
And it's different. But stating that it's not going to be there, that difference isn't going to be there, was really prevented me from really integrating it positively into my identity. It was kind of this, like, arm's length distance of, like, I don't want to integrate it into my, because the minute I do integrate it into the different aspects of my identity, I'm going to have to consider limitations.
Yeah. Almost, you know? Like, you felt like you'd have to accept defeat, and you didn't want to feel defeated.
Yes.
I understand. Yeah.
If I let my disability win, then I'm not strong. And if I'm not, you know, it was this whole cycle.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like maybe, and, you know, if we can still stay on this topic if mm-hmm. you want, but I feel like mm-hmm. it does kind of provide a good segue into the next thing I wanted to talk about. But so obviously, you know, mentally, you know, wrapping your head around this diagnosis, mm-hmm. you know, you have this thought of, I need to fight it. I need to, you know, stand against it. Like, it's not going to define me. I am, you know, I am still Bryn. You go back to school, you know, you go through high school, your early college years, you eventually transition into a, you know, psychology research you know, with your masters. So with that shift in your mentality of I'm going to fight this, it doesn't define me, to kind of shifting to, you know, I'm going to integrate this and, you know, not that I'm going to let it fully define me, but it is part of who I am. Mm-hmm. You know, do you feel like that was any encouragement into leading you into that, mm-hmm. into that field of study for your master's program? Or, you know, how did you kind of make that transition?
Yeah, it's a big gap, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, that's a lot of time.
Yeah, it's a lot of time, and then it's a lot of transformation as yeah. well.
Well, and I know there's the element of, you know, obviously you finished high school, mm-hmm. you do your undergrad, and when you did your undergrad, you know, half of that or part of that, you lived on campus. So mm-hmm. you lived away from home mm-hmm. with this disability, so that's your first time, you know, spreading your wings, for lack of a better yeah. term, yeah. being on your own with this disability and how you, you know, lived and how you figured out how to do things on your own. Like, mm-hmm. feel free to talk about that, because I'm sure that would also be helpful. But yeah. I know eventually you get to that psychology of disability is, mm-hmm. you know, essentially where I'm going with that. But yeah. anyway.
So, the difference between me being fully resistant of mm-hmm. admitting that I even have a disability
yeah.
of any kind to then doing psychological research into disability and psychology is quite the leap. And a lot of things happened in between those two things. As I grew up, I quickly realized that my will to want this thing to go away is just not happening.
Yeah.
I got weaker and weaker. And I always felt like it was something, I wasn't doing something well enough. I wasn't eating well enough. I wasn't being active enough. You know, that it was somehow, you know, I was contributing to it rather than the disease just letting itself be the disease.
Yeah.
And so I grew up and, you know, middle school was really hard. High school was really hard. You know, I wasn't necessarily a popular kid. I was kind of nerdy. I was an FFK. I just wasn't that kind of, you know, popular kid, so to speak. I got bullied lightly. It wasn't like terrible, but it was, you know, I was picked on.
Yeah.
You know, just kids being kids, you know, kids making fun of me about how I get up and down stairs, which was, you know, really, really awkward and weird looking. You know, I couldn't run in class. And so, especially in the middle school and older years, like, you know, gym classes were really just terrible because we would have to sit down and then I'd have to get up. And me even getting up from the ground was terribly awkward. And so it was like something off about her. So they just, you know, like picked on that kind of stuff. And so the response that you get at that age is that this is not normal. This is weird. And you get picked on for it.
Yeah.
And so you don't have this kind of positive association with disability very much. So fast forward to college, and I had major facial surgery. Mm. It was called Lefort 1 osteotomy with a bisagittal split.
My goodness.
It's a mouthful.
Bless you.
And so I only had like four teeth touching in the back. And they tried to correct it as best they could with just about every part of heart. I mean, I had a palate expander. I had spacers. I had, you know, at one point I had like four layers of equipment on me.
Wow.
And they, around 16 years old, they were like, we have been trying to work with your growth and we just can't, you're going to have this for the rest of your life until you get facial surgery. So the Lefort 1 osteotomy splits your upper palate into four and it moves it out. And then the bisagittal split, they cut your jaw and then they readjust it back.
Goodness.
And so for about, I would say 4 months, I was wired shut. No, it may have been like 2 months I was wired shut. And then my muscles had froze. And so I couldn't open my mouth. I had actually had to go to therapy to learn how to open my mouth back up. My family said it was the quietest 4 months they've ever had. But that's besides the point.
I was going to say, I mean, you know.
No arguments.
I love you dearly, but I cannot imagine 2 months of no talking from Bryn. That's,
it was hard for me.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I hated it.
I love you for it, but you're quite the talkative soul.
I am. Yeah, yeah. I just have a lot to say these days. So, so all of a sudden overnight, I went from always being this FFK chubby kid, and overnight I shed like 30, 40 pounds. And I looked different. But apart from me looking different.
Now, is that because you just a liquid diet or what was? OK.
Yeah. So I was on a liquid diet for, you know, 2-3 months. I could only drink like Ensures and stuff like that, which, I mean, calorically, you can drink as many as you want and you still don't have enough of the right kind of nutrients. And then over the course of the next the few months after that, since I couldn't open my mouth, like I had those, you know, like those really flat Legos, like not the normal size, but like the super flat ones.
Yes. Yeah.
For me, for my jaw surgery therapy was taking these flat Legos and one at a time stacking them on top of each other to widen my mouth.
Wow.
That's how closed my mouth was. Like I couldn't even open it a Legos worth, like a flat Legos worth.
Wow.
For months. And so you can imagine, like,
you never told me that.
Yeah, it was really painful.
Wow.
It was my jaw had completely frozen. So I had to go to this special therapist and work on reopening my mouth. And that took over, I would say, 3 to 4 months for me to just open my mouth normally.
My goodness.
So it was quite the process. And overnight, I had lost all this weight. And all of a sudden, it was easier for me to get up and down off the ground. It was easier for me to go up and down stairs. I could walk longer distances. And so this was like a light bulb went off in my brain, which was like, this is how I can control my disability is by my weight. Because if my muscles are just going to decline, the last thing I can, like, this is what I need to do in order to keep walking as long as possible. Like,
this is something you can control.
Exactly.
Yes.
This is something I can control that I finally had a leg up on my disease. And so you can imagine where this is going to go.
Yeah.
I developed a very severe eating disorder. Now, this is interesting. And this is partially why I went into psych research, is because I was very good at dismissing it. You know, and this is overlooked a lot within the disabled community, is eating disorders and people with degenerative disabilities. Because an eating disorder of any kind is most likely centered around a sense of control. It's very easy to rationalize away when you have a disability. Like my metabolism is just different, and people will believe that, you know, like they'll just say, like, I don't know anything about your disease. That sounds right.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I would say. Or I would say, you know, like,
nobody's fact checking you on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody's fact checking me. And then, you know, or I would, if people were kind of sniffing that out, I would say, but this is what I need to do in order, like, I'm being responsible over my disease. This is my version of healthy, because I'm still walking. And of course, nobody's going to say, well, I don't want you to gain weight and then go into a wheelchair, right? So in their mind, they're like, okay, that sounds smart.
Yeah, you're just looking out for yourself. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And so as this, my anorexia progressed, I went from, you know, 120 pounds. I'm 4'11", 5' on a good day,
as I always say.
You know, so I'm a pretty tiny, small thing. And so I went from, you know, 130 pounds to then 120, 120 to 110, 110 to then, you know, all the way down to 83, 82. I was starting to get 80 pounds, 00 jeans. It was starting to be a real problem. And then my parents kind of, they kind of like woke up a little bit and said, you know, they were tracking, but when it got dangerously close, that's when they were basically threatening to put me in a clinic. So then I had to figure out how to incorporate eating into my life. It was kind of forced, but I wasn't ready to let go of this control. Anorexia turned into bulimia, and I had that. And then I went away to Florida for a year, and so I was out of my parental vision. And then my eating disorder just got terribly worse. It was like a downward spiral.
Yeah.
And then that's when I reintroduced Christ into my life. I had tried, the one thing that I thought I could control was now controlling me. It was very clear. It was very clear. I had no more control. Like the lie that I thought of, like, this is how I can control my disability, or this is like, me being responsible, I was, it had full control over me. The minute I woke up, I was thinking about calories. I could not control my food anymore. It was demanding my social life. I would say no to social events because I was so afraid of being tempted with food there. I mean, it was just ridiculous stuff.
Yeah.
And I was so trapped by it. And I began my journey of self-help. I had stepped away from my faith. And I had all these journeys of self-help books. And all of them failed. And I tried my last one, and it was like, it was something like, talk to your disability as if they're a person, you know, like, and you invite them in, and, you know, and it's this kind of kooky thing. Kooky in the sense that, you know, I wasn't getting to the core of the problem, which was I was terrified of if I let go of what this was and I let my disability in, what would that look like? All of my fears would have to be flooding in. I would have to face them for, you know, since the day of my diagnosis. And this is what I would have to face. And I knew the minute that answer turned into, okay, I'm learning to let go and not have control, that's what I would have to face. And it was terrifying. Mm-hmm. I thought about exactly how I was feeling when I was 10 years old looking at that pamphlet.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I had, you know, I had a relapse. I was doing well and I had a relapse. Again, I was totally stepping away from my faith. And I felt so defeated. And I remember it was one night and, you know, God said, clear as day. It didn't come as like a booming voice or anything. You know, I just thought to pray. It was the one thing I hadn't done. And I was like, I should give this a try. You know, like go back to my roots of how I was raised. And so I just whispered a little prayer and I just said, you know, what do I have to do in order to make this go away? And clear as day, I heard him say, you need to learn how to let go and you need to trust me. You need to let go of all of these fears and I'll face them with you, but you need to let go. And so I remember responding and I said, okay, but be gentle. And that was my response. But I said, okay.
What was your feeling at that point? Was it relief? Freedom. Was it freedom?
I had, for the first time, I had total peace. I had total peace. It felt like I just unloaded like a 100-pound pack on my back. You know, I didn't have to worry about my fears anymore because I knew that someone was going to go through it with me.
Yeah.
And you know what happened the next day? I woke up and I went to work and nothing happened. You know, nothing magical happened except for I just had this new perspective. I never counted a calorie after that to this day. Never counted. I ditched all my diet plans. I ditched all of my self-help. I ditched everything.
Yeah.
Never counted a calorie again.
And I know when you've told me about this time in your life, you had it down to a science. That I mean, I know you just talked about it, but your day revolved around, you know, I can have this for these amount of hours, you know? So obviously that kind of played into, you know, I feel like that sense of relief, but kind of rope us back in on the timeline. So where are you at this point? Are you still down in Florida working at Disney? Are you back home? Like, you know,
I had just moved back home to Maryland. And so I was working at a luxury real. So we sold like houses to baseball players and stuff. It was like a luxury real estate firm, and I was a marketing assistant.
Gotcha.
At the time, I was pretty miserable working there because I was just like, "Why? Like, I don't want to. This is not what I want to make my career out of. Is like real estate." And so, but it was a paycheck, and it was, you know, something to put on my resume. And so, 2 months later. You know, I go through my day to day. I'm learning what it looks like to not be obsessed about calories or my body image, or it wasn't even body image. Like I knew I was skinny. It was more of learning how to be okay with whatever was to come.
It was your way of managing your disability.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. So, and then, you know, I had a really bad day at work one day where it was just, you know, It was terrible. I could not stand this job. I had a really bad day. My boss screamed at me over the phone. And so I went home and I was like, you know what? I got to get out of here. I got to figure out what I want to do with my life now that I don't have this thing hanging over my head. What do I want to do? And And so I go home that night. It's a Tuesday. And I put together my resume. It must have been like first or second resume I ever put together.
Yeah.
I was very like, you know, I just got out of college, went to Disney, you know, for a year because I didn't know what I was doing with my life, and then came back and was trying to figure it out. So I put it together. Wednesday morning, I get a call from an old contact that I had in the medical field. And this person worked in the field of neurology. And he goes, "Are you looking for a job by any chance?"
Well, not even 24 hours.
Not even 24 hours. Wow. After. And so I go, "Yeah, when can I start?" And so I end up starting to work as a medical office coordinator in the neurology division. I started to just ask him, can I go to clinic with you? Like, mm-hmm. if I can carve out time away from the office, like, can I just go and sit with you when you deliver diagnoses, when you are seeing a range of these, like, patients with Friedreich's ataxia, ataxia telangiectasia, you know, MS, various forms of muscular dystrophy. I just want to see how you handle, like, these relationships.
Yeah.
And he goes, absolutely. And so I end up shadowing him for quite a bit. And what I realized is that my experience of disability was not terribly unique. My difficulty that I had of integrating this into my identity was universally felt despite the condition that you have.
Interesting.
And yet I also saw these people who were incredibly bright and intelligent. And I was like, in any other situation, you could do anything you wanted. You know, you could be a lawyer, you could be a doctor, you could be, you know, an account executive. Like, you're a smart person. And so I ended up like just starting to think and like, what's the gap between their self perception and their actual self of their potential, their real potential, unbridled by disability, and how do we bridge that? You know, because the answer in between that is all how you perceive your disability. You know, society perceives it negatively. They always will. But the responsibility that you have in response of that, of like, I'm choosing to respond this way, even though I'm in a world that is not really built for me. That's what is the difference between someone who is successful and someone who is not with a disability. And so I became very interested in this. So I said, you know what? I'm young. I'm single. I want to study this further. And so I ended up pursuing my master's in clinical mental health counseling at Johns Hopkins University, and decided to do a dissertation that studied, it was a phenomenological study on perceptions and behaviors on progressive neurological disease. And basically that's a very...
I was going to say, that's a lot of words.
That's a lot of words.
More detail.
They all mean something. And every word was chosen in the title. But basically it was... And I think it's deserving to have its own separate podcast, because I'll go through what were the factors I chose. But basically it studied this bidirectional relationship between the person and society, and how both parties perceive and react to the concept of disability.
Hmm.
And what it was and what it was really designed to do was to, part one is to recognize there are people out there who have bias, who have stigma.
Yeah.
Sure. You have implicit and explicit bias, more so than any other marginalized population. That's there.
Mm-hmm.
Part B is what I thought was missing in the research, was how do we respond? What is the proper response for that to make someone successful, regardless of those barriers? Because everybody has barriers, right?
Yeah.
Like, just because you have a disability doesn't mean that the other person has some invisible thing that they are warring through. It could be mental illness. It could be a bad upbringing. It's just yours is more visible. So that's what my research was on. I'll do the podcast for a different day.
Yeah.
But that was kind of how I formulated this research.
Yeah. So very passionate about mental health research, mm-hmm. especially in the realm of disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
For anybody that knows our journey and, you know, life with Killian at the very beginning when he was first born, they knew you were in law school. You talked about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So describe that transition.
Mm-hmm.
You were so passionate and still are,
mm-hmm.
about, you know, mental health regarding disability. how did that, you know, how did you transfer or how did you transition the, you know, careers so readily?
Yeah.
Or maybe not so readily. And now, obviously, you know, there's a lot to your story.
Yeah.
So I feel like maybe we could go in more in depth with a lot of the transition in maybe a later episode. I know we've kind of talked on that of, you know, this is, you know, our background. This is why you should listen to us. Awesome. Great. I would, you know, we definitely want to hear it. But, you know, maybe all the details we could save for a later episode. Just, I guess, highlight the, you know, the idea of how you decided to transition your career.
So I started practicing being a formal counselor, and I loved the idea of it, and I loved the concept of it, and I was good at it, but I still felt like there was an opportunity, like there was a part of my skill set that was not being utilized, and I wanted to impact the world more broadly, and I just didn't know what that was. So soon enough, and as nearing the end of my program, that's like when you do practicum stuff and you're like a real counselor under supervision and stuff like that. So I'm doing that, but I'm also still working full time. And a new therapy had actually recently been approved. And since I had, you know, such good relationships with these families after shadowing and being a part of the clinic, they, you know, just ended up asking me to develop the program to allow this therapy to be administered to all of these families who could use it. And so I did that, and I found, I was like, this work is amazing. We had nothing but problems in the beginning, but we had a wonderful administration to help us navigate. And so I was like pulling books off shelves, looking at like legal frameworks and how to get workarounds and drug distribution models. And it was so fascinating to me. But overnight, you know, again, I told you I had shadowed these conversations another neurologist had every day with these families. And overnight, the narrative switched from, "Oh, sorry, your child has this diagnosis. There's nothing we can do," to, "Your child has this diagnosis, but we have a treatment available that will help." And I was like, this is amazing. I then looked into the research of FDA new drug submissions, and this particular technology, gene therapies, all of these things are flooding the industry. And so these once rare disease who were very, very abandoned for many years are now getting the attention it deserves because the technology is there. And so I said, this is where I want to go. And again, I had this thought. I was like, I'm young and I'm single. I'm not going to have both of those things for very much longer. So I'm going to do all of my education now. I don't want to be 40 years old and going back to get my MBA. So if there's any hint of what a degree I want to be successful in this industry, I'm going to get it now. And so I did my dual degree, my MBA and JD up at Case Western.
And where is Case Western?
It's in Cleveland, Ohio, the best
city in the world.
The best city in the world. It really is.
Amen.
I would move back there in a flash. To my mom, if you're listening to that, that's not a real threat. Maybe it is.
Maybe. We'll see. We'll see if I have anything to say about it. Great. So, you know, you decide, let's go back to school again for, what is this now, the third time?
Yeah.
Going to a new city. Obviously a transition in terms of your career, you know, as you already talked about. But in a way, what you wanted to do with your degrees that you're now getting your law degree or your JD and, you know, your MBA, it's almost kind of marrying a lot of these degrees or a lot of this research and the work that you've done into one thing.
Yes.
So I know there's been a lot of talk about like, oh, you know, I did all the, you know, all these acronyms. I feel like that was very, you know, instrumental in getting you where you needed to be. And, you know, anyway, where I'm going with this. So
you're right. I'll piggyback on that because even in psychology, there's so much that goes into medical decision making. And a lot of that has to do with how you perceive your disability. And so to your point, I think you're right. They all marry together. It was just a very unconventional path as to where I thought all of these would actually be used.
Yeah. So anybody that's been following our story for any period of time, you know, they know that you went to law school. While you were finishing law school, you were pregnant with Killian. We had to up and relocate our entire lives. You know, do you mind just going in a little bit more detail on that? And obviously we can, you know, further, you know, dive into it further in subsequent episodes. But Just tell us a little bit about where you were at, where your head was at as a mom mm-hmm. in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, being pregnant and doing law school and your MBA is not a walk in the park. Being pregnant while in law school and doing your MBA with a disability is also not a dream. Being in law school while blah, 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 and then you find out your kid is going to have a heart defect and you need to move to Boston in 5 weeks is also not a walk in the park. So, yeah, it was a lot to manage. We were also in our first year of marriage, so.
Yeah.
We were.
That's another detail that kind of goes overlooked sometimes.
It does go overlooked.
Yeah.
But it's such a.
As if our lives weren't crazy enough. Oh, you know, Killian was a honeymoon souvenir and we were just married.
Right.
We were just figuring out each other.
Like it was, but it was also the best time. Yeah, it was hard, but the best part of that entire journey, though, was that I didn't have to do it alone. You know, I had done life when we got married. I was 29. So I had done life alone up until that point. And as challenging as it was, the best part of that was that I knew we didn't have to go through this without each other, and that was really refreshing. So
preparing obviously for that, you know, mm-hmm. Killian has his diagnosis, not even born yet. As a mom, is there anything that you felt you had to do to prepare? Like take the move out of the equation, take a lot of the extra stuff mm-hmm. out. Mm-hmm. But you, with your own disability, mm-hmm. getting the diagnosis of Killian, you know, as a mom, mm-hmm. how did you handle that? I guess, what was your initial gut reaction or your first thoughts?
To get to
the diagnosis. And obviously, our next episode is going to go into a lot more detail.
Yeah.
It's just a little teaser.
Yeah, a little teaser.
Yeah.
It was crushing, you know, and... But it was also weird. There were so many weird coincidences in that short, like, 1 hour that we found everything out. Like, we named him Killian 30 seconds before we got a diagnosis.
Yeah.
And
for those that don't know, Killian means little warrior in Gaelic.
Yeah. And then, like, as we're investigating in between appointments, we find out that these kiddos are named Heart Warriors. Like,
right.
There were so many things that God was like, this is a much grander journey that I'm going to have you guys go down. That even then there was like, you know, that constant rhythm of like through all the doubt and the fear.
Yeah.
So, but that's a little teaser. We're going to talk a lot more about that in our next episode. It's all about Killian and his journey, so that people are kind of looped into the other side of our rare life.
Thank you guys so much for listening. Join us next time on our podcast where we talk about Killian. From his diagnosis all the way up until today. Be sure to follow the podcast on Instagram @the_beautifully_rare_life and subscribe to our podcast feed on Apple Podcasts. Have a great day. We'll see you next time.